This is continuing with Radha Krishnan on 28th March, 72. The first part of this interview is on tape 12A and B. Now, you were talking about your polarization.
Yeah, I think that's rather interesting from a purely personal point of view, the amount of hard work that went into trying to do something very different that really didn't get there. There's what I think is a paper which should have been a very important paper but wasn't, published by Dave and myself. But the trouble with polarization measurements before that time was that they were very crude, and so we tried to find to develop some technique where you could measure very small amounts of polarization. And as far as I'm concerned, I think you can check this by going into the literature. People couldn't have been sure whether they were measuring 1% or 2%, and that was the sort of accuracy to which they worked, and they never found anything at the the decimeter of the mix and so on. And then after we'd gone through months of blood and sweat, we ended up with a system where we could measure polarization to a tenth of a percent, provided the signal-to-noise ratio was good. In other words, the instrumentals could be taken up to a tenth. And so we said, let's pick six strong sources and do this. And we picked six strong sources and we ground them out to one of them. I think our RNA was chosen as a calibrator because it was an H2 region. And so we tried to measure the polarization of the others in terms of that to a tenth of a percent. And the crab, as I say, had been, its optical polarization had been measured. Connie Mayer had shown that it was 7% at 3 centimeters, and later that it was 3% at 10 centimeters. At 21 centimeters, many people like Westerhout and Rob Davies and so on have made measurements, gotten nowhere, and given limits of something like 1% or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Well, we showed that it was, I think, 1.3 plus or minus 1% with the position angle for it, and there was nothing on the other sources. And it's just one of those quirks of fate, because we picked the six sources that weren't polarized at that frequency.
Did you say 1.3 plus or minus 1?
Plus or minus 0.1.
0.1, okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, some minute thing. And we drew, I think, one was perhaps the first sort of diagram of the kind that Dave was showing, where you could try and see whether it in fact did follow lambda squared law
or
not. So, but anyway, I was just mentioning that we started to play with techniques, which is what interested me a great deal, to try and develop a different technique and then to use it for something. And then the Australian measurements by Gardner and White Oak, I think, really broke this thing wide open. Just as we were doing a second survey at 10 centimeters of polarization, we read their paper in the PhysRev letters where they measured polarization in 10 sources or so.
Using which dish was this?
This was the Park Stone dish.
Some of the first observations of it.
Some of the very first. And because we found that practically every other source that we looked at was polarized too.
Yeah.
There's like 273 and so on were all first measured there. But then, by the time we got to, there was a conference called the Physics of Non-Thermal Sources, at which Vulture, I think, first talked about the depolarization in Cygnus. Connie Mayer, in the meantime, had measured Cygnus and so on. So in fact, that had happened before the Australia.
This was a NASA conference?
Yeah, it was held at Goddard Space
I've seen the proceedings of it,
But really, if you're trying to look for a historic source, it was really NRL and Connie mostly that started the whole business.
The polarization.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, that's the impression I have.
Absolutely. I mean,
because before that, people said you can't do it.
He was
willing to go ahead and do it.
There was just one pioneer, really. But then, we were avoiding looking at extended sources at Caltech because we had spent so much time studying instrumental polarization, and we discovered that off-axis effects were very, very important, and that unless you had very special dishes and feeds, the moment you went off-axis you could get instrumental effects. So for some strange reason we avoided looking at extended sources. And finally, we got around to it at some stage. We discovered that there were very weird effects. And so immediately we pursued that, and then we realized that sources like Hercules and 3C 353 and so on had components of the polarized in different directions. So that eventually became George Sandstein's thesis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I got very interested in trying to, Dave, and I got very interested in trying to sort out the principle of how you measure polarization distributions with an interferometer. All this business right. of treating Stokes parameters differently, and very many interesting things like that there was no system you could build which had a response only to one Stokes parameter. Anyway, it's all in that. It's all in that
right.
particular paper. And then one of the other things that I was interested in was trying to make a system for measuring, using the interferometer to measure the Zeeman effect. And, well, that didn't get anywhere. And then I decided that the interferometer was the best way to detect OH.
You never published anything on the Zeeman?
No, not at all. Barry and Dave and Bob Wilson did, because they carried on. I went off to Bell Labs at a certain stage because they offered us a couple of masers, and they wanted someone to go and build the masers at Bell Labs.
I see.
So I left, and they carried on.
Where was this, Clark and...
Apche.
In Apche?
Everything. Yeah, Apche. And that was a very interesting system too, because it's all very simple these days, but simply by setting the feeds at right angles to each other, you end up with a system which has a positive response to one sense of circular, a negative response to the other, so it automatically measures the difference, which is precisely what you want with the same effect.
Right.
And then I got interested in OH. None of these really came to anything, so you shouldn't put all these in your book. They'll probably interest you. And I decided that the interferometer was the best way to measure OH. And so I went to a lot of trouble to build receivers and feeds and so on. And this was happening at the same time as many other things. A lot of this polarization stuff came up in the meantime. And I think it's rather amusing if you find some of the early papers, the polarization measurements from Caltech, which were published, which were at 1420, 1666,
yeah.
and something else.
Right.
And then I got interested in...
Now, what became of the OH? I mean, you never did any, you never published any OH work from
Caltech, did you? I had a number of unsuccessful attempts, and just about the time...
What were you trying to do, exactly?
Just detect it. This was before OH was found.
Oh.
That's what's so interesting.
Before OH emission was found?
Before OH anything was found.
Absorption also?
Anything was found.
I see. And where did you look?
Oh, Cass. But the first time I looked, the first two occasions I looked through the single dish, but the receiver wasn't working very well. I remember I ran out of time once, and then John Bolton came up and said, "That's enough, you've had enough time on the dish, get off now."
What were you expecting? Certainly not the strong non-thermal signal.
Oh, no, no. This was before any other molecule or anything
yeah.
was found, remember?
Well,
it's hard for you to imagine that.
Well, but I'm interested. I mean, I've heard it happens that many of my first interviews have been with people involved in the OH game.
Yeah.
And,
The only paper that had been published before was by Barrett and Lilly, where they looked for OH in the sun. It was an NRL preprint or something in a blue cover, which I had read backwards and
NRL
forwards.
Report, yeah.
Yeah, many, many times, and I decided we could do this better.
So,
was looking
can you just tell me, I mean, since this is not published, I mean, what sort of bandwidth were you using?
Oh, just 6 cases, I suppose. I was looking for something like the absorption profile, for precisely what Weinrib and Barrett and company did later. It's just that the single dish measurements were very poor, and therefore they didn't succeed. And the interferometer methods got delayed because I went off to Bell, and anyway, they just didn't get done. But you must be very careful, and I don't think you should bring a lot of this up, because it's always like people trying to get credit. I mean, it's already telling you the story. It helps you to understand personalities and so on. And you spend a lot of time working on a lot of things that didn't work out. But it's not, this is well known, everybody knows this. Everybody knows I was very interested in this sort of thing. But it's not something you have. So, you know.
Okay.
It's just for you. Then I got interested in, then I figured that if you could cut down the, if you bring the signal noise down, you could use the interferometer method to look at an enormous number of sources for H-line absorption. This is why I went up to Bell Labs, because I thought that would really do it. See? And I got the masers, but by the time I came back with them, I got one working, and you know, things got delayed. In the meantime, I decided I wanted to buy this boat and go off and so on and so. So nothing really came of that other than showing that it could have been done. And it was just a terrible shame that instead of Caltech immediately following the thing and cleaning up the subject, which would have left nothing for me to do 5 years later, nothing happened there. See?
What did they do with the measures?
They never used them afterwards. I think Dave Rokstad tried one once, made it work, but they didn't. Anyway, before I went away, I did something else. There was another problem in which I was very interested. And here again, it was a combination of trying to combine a new technique with something that would be interesting astronomically. It was to use the interferometer to study external galaxies. The first measurements were made again at Caltech. This was in one maser, on one dish, and one on the other. And I was interested in just using the phase. I thought if you start with edge-on galaxies, all you have to do is measure the shift of the phase, the different frequencies, and you'll find the shift of positions and so on. So I spent a lot of time putting this machine together, and John Whyto, who was a Carnegie fellow working at the Wilson and Palomar Observatories, and who was going to join the radio astronomy group, came over and joined the observation simply because he was interested in this sort of thing, and George Sunstein was a student there at the time. He was sort of also in it. And that appeared as a paper later by Sunstein and Whyto.
Now this was hydrogen in external systems. This is the first interferometric study of it.
Right.
Right, I know that paper. Too.
Yeah, I think a lot of their interpretation is has been questioned and so on. But anyway, that was the first time this sort of thing was done. And I'm trying to remember if there was anything else. That was of real importance at Caltech. I can't.
Well, if you think of
there might have been minor things. Anyway, during all of this, you see, I spent over a year at Bell Telephone Labs, which was one of the most rewarding years I've spent, in the sense that I was teaching people nothing and learning at a fantastic rate, in the sense that, you know, wherever I looked, there was something new and interesting going on.
In electronics, primarily, or?
Oh, everything. Physics. To me, I never had such an intake of physics since perhaps during university or something like that.
Okay, well, if you think of anything else at Caltech, feel free to bring it in a few months later. Could you just give me a few facts about your fabled boat trip? You know, I know a lot of stories, but... But first, why did it start in England, and how long did it take, and things like this?
Oh, you want a few facts. Well, this is something I've been planning since I was 18. In other words, I've been planning for some 15 years at least. Before it actually took place. And I've just been waiting, you know. You This is often the way with me. I have an idea, but I sort of wait for the right moment. You never know when it's going to arrive. When I was at Bell, Derek Scovell, in whose group I was working, he said, "Do you know there's a new kind of boat?" That's when I addressed him. I said, "What is it?" And he said, "Oh, it's got three holes." And spelled it. Trimaran, there's a bloke in California. I was designing them. And this started the whole thing off, and then when I went back to California, I went and saw Piva, who was the designer. And then I decided that's the kind of boat I wanted, partly because it was different, there was an element, extra element of adventure in this thing. And then the thing that appealed to me about this was also that it was very cheap, because Piva's designs were meant for home builders, and he claimed that you could have a boat, certain accommodation for a fraction of the price. Now, I wasn't going to spend years building a boat, and I wasn't very sure that I could make a good job, so I started looking around for cheap places where I could get one built. You see, I wrote to Australia and found out, because I thought I would go to Australia next, and so on and so on. And then I remember an interesting conversation when I was visiting Martin Ryle on the way to some conference in Europe, and then I said, "Say, Martin, you heard this? You find the boat?" He said, "What kind?" I said, "A trimaran." At that stage, he informed me that he had built the first trimaran in England. Ryan's a great sailor. It was a little one.
Yeah.
He was familiar with. And then I said, "Oh, I'm interested in buying or in getting a pirate trimaran. Is there any place where I can get it built?" And he said, "Yes, they build them at Cox Marine in Great Yarmouth, which is 25 miles from here," and, you know, one thing led to another, and before I knew what, his secretary had fixed up an appointment for me the following morning. I rented a car and drove off, you see, I placed an order for.
I see.
For one. And then I went back to the States, and I thought about it a little more. I think I told them I would order one, but I didn't actually send them the money. Then I went back and decided that this was it, and now was the time I had to do this. So I placed an order and sent them part of the money. And I was going through all this business of selecting people. And I knew that this is one of the most difficult things to do. And I know any number of skippers have come to grade for because they've picked the wrong crew. And so I knew so much about the difficulties of doing this that I wasn't going to make any mistakes. So I told myself, I think I made out all right. But it was interesting that during all this, when I was doing some calculations about the amount of money that it cost me to get this boat and so on and so on, I had it all written up on my blackboard, and Dave Morris worked in. You see, I mean, I'd known Dave for years and worked with him. Never ever mentioned the word boat to him, and he'd never been on one before. And he said, "What are you doing? What's all this about?" And I said, "Dave, I've decided I'm going to sail to Australia, and I've ordered this boat. Just, you know, I'm doing my sums on the board, and I find that I'm short of money. But I'm damned if I'm going to give this thing up. I just have to find some other way of getting the money, because I'm going, and I'm going in a few months." And Dave said, "I have some money." He said, "Are you crazy? Do you know what this means? This boat's 35 feet long, going across the oceans and so on. Have you ever been on a sailboat before?" Not that I had much experience, but anyway, I wanted to do this. And Dave made one of those classic remarks, typically Davian remarks, and he said, "You're not suggesting that one should spend one's life doing the sort of thing we're doing here. Anything is better than..." And that was it, you know. It had never occurred to me, but I realized in that instant that was the kind of man I wanted.
Yeah.
So that was how Dave got on the trip.
Now, you already had a job in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Dave...
Well, John Bolton had left Caltech years before that. In fact, he was the one who gave me my job at Caltech, but he left a couple of years after I went to Caltech. So a lot of this work that we were telling you about, that I've been telling you about, was done after John Bolton left.
Yeah. And
Yeah, and when he left, he said, "Why don't you come to Australia?" And I said, "Yeah, I've been wanting to go to Australia, and now that you have a big telescope, it's perfect. And so I wrote off at one stage before this boat business came up in its immediate form.
Yeah.
They gave me a job. And then I got this chance to go to Bell Telephone Labs to build these mazes. And when Joe Posey was there for the 61 IAU at Berkeley, I told him, look, I just can't come to Australia. I want to go to Bell Labs to build this mazer. And then I would like to use it and so on. Can I have another year or two? At that time, one believed, you know, they suggested that it would only take 2 or 3 months to put the mazer together. So I thought I'd have another few months of use with it and I'd take off. I didn't realize how complicated it was. Joe Posey said, oh no, it's very good, it'll be useful to have someone who knows about mazes and so on. And so that was a year or 2 years, and then I reapplied for the job. And then I said I'd be there in 6 months or 8 months. And it turned out, by the time I got to Australia, I'd had that job for over 4 years, and they kept it for me. You know, it's the most frustrating thing that could have happened. But Dave didn't have a job.
He got it after he got to Australia.
Yeah. Well, I think he applied. So I bought the boat in England because it was cheap. And also it gave us a chance of going across both the Atlantic and the Pacific. And I think on his way to join me, as he passed through London, I think he put his application in at the Australian House.
But he didn't know about it until he got to Australia?
Something like
that. Okay, so how long did it take you now? From
18 months.
18 months. From England to the Panama Canal was how long?
Well, we did it the wrong way. That was perhaps the only thing that I would change if I had to do it again, so to speak. It's the ratio of time spent in different places along the trip.
Yeah.
It took us, we spent a year between the date of leaving the place where the boat was launched in England, where we actually cruised on the coast of England for a while and then Europe and so on. But between the date we left Great Yarmouth and the date we left Panama was 1 year.
Mm-hmm. And just 6 months.
And only 6 months across the Pacific, whereas it should have been the other way around, because the Pacific is twice as long and there are twice as many interesting islands.
And how many people was this across?
There were only three permanent members, of which Dave was the only truly permanent crew member. There were two others who were interested, two Americans who were interested. Dan Harris.
Who I've heard of, yes.
Well, he was a graduate student, also a radio astronomer at Caltech. And then there was another friend of mine, I was in this ocean science and engineering. And because I had decided that you couldn't have more than three on long trips from the point of view of loading the boat, it's the weight of water and food and so on.
Yeah.
I asked them to split the trip between them, that Dan Harris would go across the Atlantic and Sid Shaw would go across the Pacific, so that's how it worked out. Dan, who was then in Italy after having left Caltech, he got a degree at Caltech and then he went to Bologna. And he quit his job there and joined us in England. I went across the Atlantic and he got off at Arecibo, took a job there. And then Sid Shaw joined us in the West Indies.
And what was the length of this boat? That's one other factor.
35 feet.
35 feet. Okay. So this brings us to CSIRO. In what year?
Christmas Eve, 65.
65, end of 65. And what did you begin working on there?
Actually, I don't think I did anything much for a year or two. I was interested in doing this, doing something about the Zeeman business, which hadn't broken yet, really.
You mean with the screw at Green Bank?
Yeah. But I got interested in other things and delayed building of feed and so on, so nothing ever really came of it. The antenna group did succeed in producing a very, very fancy feed which I think is perhaps the best one in the world for that sort of thing, and we did publish one paper on it. This was very, very recent. This was long after.
On the field, you mean?
No. I mean, one Zeeman measurement on Orion.
Yes, that's right, in astrophysical letters.
Yeah.
I just saw it, yeah.
The synthetic profile and all this sort of thing. But that was after the fact. But I was mostly interested in, I was playing around with hydrogen line absorption. I started playing around with it, and then I was interested in line interferometry. So I thought, it's time to do OH interferometry, because it had never been done before. So I went through hell getting that interferometer to work on OH. At that time, it had never been
done. Which interferometer? The 60-foot?
Parkes interferometer.
210, but that was already there when you got there.
Right. It just managed to...
Who was the guiding force behind getting that
interferometer?
Being the interferometer. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a number of people who built the various bits, but he was not.
Yeah.
The first major use of that instrument was Romica's thesis. Ask him, he'll tell you all about it. He was the one who really used it. They used a very clever method of using two frequencies, one which was three times the other, and the ratio of the baselines, the maximum to minimum baselines, was 3:1. And so they had fringes on two frequencies, and they could use the lower frequency fringe to give them a phase reference for the higher frequency, because the higher frequency would get resolved before the lower frequency.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very clever method of getting... It was also the first interferometer where you could actually make measurements with one telescope charging down the railway track.
Well, it was actually moving.
All of Bowen's measurements were made with the telescope moving. So it was a very interesting instrument, but I wanted to use it for line work, and I sort of put it together haywire style for line observations and measured W49, OH, and different polarizations and so on. And by the time I had the machine put together and started making observations, there was this paper by
Raymond Eliason.
Right, Cutterback and so on from Caltech, where they looked at...
Never published
it? Oh yes, it was published, but it's not great.
Where was this published?
In the Australian...
On W49 interferometer positions?
Mm-hmm. Not positions, it was just showing the sizes of the two globes and something about the polarization button. It wasn't a complete study, it was a very preliminary. Then I spent a lot of time looking for OH in the Magellanic Clouds. That was another minor paper.
Right, I'm familiar with that one.
Then I got interested in really doing this line stuff seriously. I should turn it off for a minute. And I want to make one remark about this Magellanic paper on an unsuccessful search. Let me make it very clear, I don't want you to mention this, I mean, if you want, because it's a trivial thing, but there's something that's interesting about it. I'm sort of ashamed about having published that paper, because it's one of the few papers that I've written when I found nothing. Now, you could actually argue and say that it's very important that you announce that you didn't succeed in doing something so other people won't waste their time looking for the same sort of thing. Everybody has his own pet perversions and so on, and one of mine is that the kind of impatience with people who publish negative results. And it's hard for you to appreciate the number of... And you ask me what I've been doing, you see, but most of the time I've achieved nothing, therefore I don't publish. But I spend an awful lot of time looking for things which I haven't found, and which I could never bring myself to write a paper, I mean, because I'd say...
Well, and you don't try to say things either, I mean, you try something...
No, for example, you see, you asked me what I was doing, I spent an awful lot of time looking for H2+ in Australia. For example, there was this business about the, remember the first non-thermal, there were a couple of sources in which non-thermal OH emission was detected in front, anomalous OH emission was detected in front of non-thermal sources, W28 and W44, I think Malagros or something had done one and somebody else had done another, which immediately prompted the question, this was years ago, in my mind, as to whether this was amplification of the signal from the continuum source behind or whether it was, and so on, because all this had been kicked around in connection with the OH from H2 regions, where it hadn't yet been shown that the OH emission regions were actually perhaps removed from the H2 centers. And